Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Sports Tonight on BSL Radio. Join Rob Shields and Mike Weber as they talk about the Baltimore Orioles, Baltimore Ravens, University of Maryland Terrapins, and more. Be part of the show. Call us at 347-215-8391.
Hello and welcome back to Sports Tonight. Unlike what the introduction says, we are not with Sports Tonight with Rob and Mike anymore. My former colleague Mike Weber has left the show and he has now been replaced by BSL owner and founder Chris Stoner. So it's now Sports Tonight with Rob and Chris. So Chris, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, we'll try and get the intro taken care of at some point. Another thing on the old to-do list.
All right, well, we were going to launch the show last Monday, but with everything that happened on in Baltimore, we just didn't feel it was the right time to do it. So we're starting this week, and we're in quite of a week we've got here in the last, you know, since Mike and I were last on and whatnot, when we look outside of what happened in Baltimore, just in the sports world, it's been quite a week, capped off by a pretty amazing sports weekend. We'll get into the NFL draft and the NBA and all in a little bit, but we're going to start off talking about the Orioles tonight. they had this weekend, because of the events in Baltimore, they had to be pushed to Tampa. So we had a home series down in Tampa. The Orioles were able to win 2 out of 3, so that whole idea of losing some home field advantage, at least they were able to win the series. So that may not be something that you look at later if they are out of the division by a game or two or out of the playoffs or something like that, and look at that as something that was a disadvantage to the team. So that's good. So, Chris, just what were your thoughts on, you know, how last week was handled in turn for the Orioles with having to push the game to the, you know, nothing with no crowd on the Wednesday game and then having to have the series down in Tampa?
I guess last week's, you know, it's been a long week, but I joined a Canadian talk show, I guess their version of Today Show last week, and they were pressing me on playing, I guess it was the Wednesday game against the White Sox in an empty stadium, and asking my points, viewpoints there, and my basic takeaway was that it was the right thing to do for where the city was at the time, and that there were far larger concerns than playing in front of an empty crowd, and that, to me, it just seemed fairly logical that you would that they would do that without giving law enforcement something else to worry about. I was going to save it for the end, but I'll just go ahead and pull it out now. I don't know if this would be a regular feature for us, but my jackass of the week is Nestor Aparicio, and if we do this as a regular feature, I'm sure he's going to be a multiple time winner. But that takeaway that he had was just absolute garbage of using that as another ranting point for him and Angelos, and particularly the Orioles. It was way past the Orioles, Major League Baseball, and the concern was definitely with asking law enforcement to be have something else to deal with. It's just an insane takeaway to think that last Wednesday that they definitely should have played in front of a crowd. But moving past that, you know, going to Tampa, again, based off of the events that were on the ground and the decision and when they had to make it, that made sense. I was particularly pleased with, you know, Tampa had been playing fairly well, after Friday that the Orioles were able to come back and get that another series win. I'm pretty happy with where the Orioles are at this point.
Yeah, I mean, we'll get into some – the individual aspects of the team and certain players and all that kind of stuff here in a moment. But, you know, with all the injuries that they've had, the starting pitching was awful for the first 2.5-3 weeks of the season. And that has really settled down, which is obviously the key to how they've been playing lately. But it's been quite a week for them. I agree. First of all, you don't want to have to totally cancel the series against the White Sox. It makes it that much harder to make up for it, especially when it's not in the division where you play them so many times. You were able to get the one game in. I can understand an idea of putting the fans in the stands and letting the city get behind something positive, there might be a value to that. But in this particular instance, there is more value into not bringing in 7, 8, 10, 15,000 people, however many people would have showed up, and caused that much more of a circus downtown with everything else that was going on. So at some point, as nice as it would be for people to have that distraction, there was much more important things to deal with than to worry about, well, let's have the fans distracted for a little bit. Fans could have taken off and just watched the game and everything else and been distracted that way. They didn't be there to have that.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems fairly logical. I was very surprised to see any dissenting viewpoint, and then when I did, I guess I wasn't surprised to see who had it.
Yeah.
As you said, we'll get into the Orioles overall, but, you kind of nailed it. The Orioles, the pitching had been very poor over the first three and a half weeks. It settled down, and between that and the injuries and some of the guys you're missing, and the play had been very sloppy. But over the past week, week 10 days, they've seemed to kind of corrected that. The starting pitching has been better. That allows you to set up the bullpen. And the only thing that I'm seeing doesn't look really sustainable long-term from what we're seeing early on is probably the on-base percentage, which is fourth overall in baseball. You would probably expect them to regress there, become kind of more middle of the pack overall. But I fully expect the slugging to maintain, to be an upper one-third offense overall in terms of runs scored. And I think the pitching, especially the starting pitching, will rebound from their early start and be at least closer to more middle of the pack. And then lastly, the point that you've really keyed on all winter was, one of the Orioles' biggest attributes is their defense, which to me can only improve, especially as Hardy gets back. And obviously he's begun his rehab assignment tonight in Bowie.
Yeah, I expect an improvement in the on-base percentage this year. I said that before the season started. A guy like Travis Snyder, adding him in, he's a patient guy. He'll walk more. You figure you get an improvement from Chris Davis. You figure Weeder's coming back. That'll improve over what we had last year at catcher, although Caleb Joseph has been great so far this year. I think the biggest development this year is what we're seeing patience-wise out of Machado. If Manny becomes a 60 to 80 walk guy, which the minor league statistics tell you is not out of the realm of possibility. I don't know about 80, but he should be somewhere in that 55 to 70 range. If he can be that and all of a sudden he's a 370-ish on-base percentage guy instead of a 340, that really elevates his game and probably makes him a perennial MVP candidate, assuming that the defensive issues that he's had early on with the throwing are just him being a slump with throwing, maybe not trusting the knee 100% yet when he's planting, things like that. So that to me so far has been the best thing about this season, because that really will push him to a whole nother level. And in turn, it's going to help push the offense to another level. So let's get into that offense for a moment here. You just mentioned the on-base percentage, the slugging. The Orioles are third in the AL in on base at the moment. Their OPS is first in baseball. It's first in the American League. They've tailed off a little bit in some of the other individual team stats because they just have missed so much time lately. So it's a little bit misleading. But overall, we're waiting to get Hardy back, waiting to get Weeders back. So we'll see once we get these guys back. Scope will probably. I haven't heard really any updates lately, but we're still probably talking about another month or so. Once we get these pieces back, if we ever put the whole team out on the field, I think you have to feel really good about this offense, which is saying something considering you see what Nelson Cruz is doing in Seattle and you say, well, gosh, we really could, it'd be great to have that. But we're, as an offense, they're not actually missing a beat even without him, despite what he's doing so far in Seattle.
Yeah, despite what Cruz is doing, they're second overall in slugging percentage, and that's with, without Weeders, without Hardy, and now Scope has now missed a couple of weeks. I mean, it's to me, the slugging percentage, you know, to me, I expect him to be in that top five. And the runs, I'm expecting a top 10 offense. And I think what you mentioned about Machado, I was pretty strong on him going on into the year. I expected gains kind of pretty much across the board of him. I thought that some of the projections for him seemed a little low, and I think that was being what people were looking at for the numbers that he did accumulate last year. I mean, those numbers counted, but if you're aware of Machado last year, so he missed spring training, then he missed April, and then he came in and played in May without much preparation, and May was just a total mess for him, and it was obviously his spring training. He was behind. And then as he warmed up, got some games under his belt, he was in a good groove, and unfortunately, when he went down again to injury. But to me, this year, I expected him to be able to stay in the lineup, and if he did produce, the errors so far that we've seen, to me, that's a little bit of an aberration. And offensively, it's nice to see his bat warming up. I think you definitely need it. And I agree, if his bat improves a little bit, especially with the patience there, combined with the defense that you do expect, that's quite an overall package that Machado brings. One of the names you mentioned there that I think is a little interesting, someone to discuss, is Snyder. I'm curious of what you've seen from him directly and what you're kind of expecting to see from him the rest of the year.
Well, first of all, whether you want to trust the defensive statistics or not, the defensive statistics in his career, in not large sample sizes because he has moved around the diamond, tell you that he is not good in right field and he's average or a little bit better in left field. In the sampling that we've seen, he's not good in right field. I don't know if it's the angle of the ball. I don't know what it is, but you know, he hasn't played in left field that much, but to me, in the couple games that he has been out there, he's just looked a little comfortable. Again, a little more comfortable, I mean. But again, it's a small sampling, and you don't want to read too much in it. But defensively, that's what we're seeing. That's what it seems like. The defensive stacks, while they're maybe not 100% foolproof by any means, they're still kind of backing up what you're seeing with your eye. offensively, I've actually been pretty impressed by him. You know, he's got good power. He's hitting the ball all over the field. He's using all fields, and the patience is really huge. I mean, he's essentially replaced Markakis in that regards, in terms of what he's doing with pitch recognition, not, you know, going deep in the counts and things like that. And the Orioles needed that type of a guy in this lineup. Now, we'll see. This is a guy that was once a top prospect, and never lived up to anything. The second half of last year, something clicked with him, and he had a good year, and it's starting off well this year. So we'll see. I'm not jumping in the water with both feet with him by any means. We need to see more of it from him. But I think as a fan, you have to look at this and say, you know, you're upset that Markakis is gone. You would like to have, you know, his defense, what he brought in the clubhouse and things like that. But I think overall what we're getting on the field, you really haven't seen any kind of a drop-off with Snyder. And if anything, Snyder might be a better offensive player at this point in their careers because of the neck injury to Markakis and maybe how much that has zapped some power from him.
Well, where I really agree with you is the idea of needing to see more. I think Snyder... basically what we've seen so far, I think we see a guy that's most of the time is having pretty good at bats. He's being 8 walks against the 17 Ks. That's pretty good. He's hitting for the average is fine. Would actually like to see a little bit more slugging out of him. It's somebody that especially remember coming up that does have power. I'm looking to see that. He's struggling a little bit so far against righties, not playing much against lefties, but overall, he seems to be having good at bats when he is getting wood on the ball. You see a lot of ball, you know, looks like Walt Riniak, a lot of shots up the middle. As far as defensively, you know, obviously you can't get a smaller sample size than just a couple games. But when you started the year in Tampa, he made a couple of plays right away, a couple diving catches, showed the arm right away. I was thinking, well, maybe he's better than I expected defensively. So you saw Jones comment that he didn't anticipate that level of range from Snyder. And then since then, you've seen a number of mental errors. You wondered if it just got into his head a little bit at some point. Or like you said, there are different factors playing left or right. You know, that's going to impact his playing time as well throughout the rest of the year, his ability to at least be average-ish in the outfield. Certainly one to watch. They got him, you know, he's only 27 years old, so he certainly has an opportunity here to get some regular playing time and show what he can be as a player. But for his cost, what he is, I mean, he's been a fine acquisition so far.
It's pretty telling that they're putting Delmon Young in the outfield. Now, I have to say, first of all, Delmon Young does have a very good arm. And to me, he looks like he's in a little bit better shape this year. He looks like he's moving around a little bit better, so he may not be completely helpless out in the field. But it does appear, at least for the moment, that they feel a little bit more confident with Delmon Young out there than they do Snyder. Now, part of that is also they're not getting a whole lot from Diaz at the moment. They've also held Pierce out some, more so than you would have thought early in the season because he was struggling with the bat. So, and Young is hitting, so they're putting him out there. And with, you know, Snyder and, you know, a defensive slump or whatever it is you want to call it, they're feeling a little bit more confident in Delmon Young right now. But I personally value the outfield defense and whatnot, but to me, as long as Snyder is getting in there, I wouldn't have him facing the overly tough lefties, but assuming that he continues production, I don't see any reason that he doesn't get 450 to 500 at-bats, which is essentially almost playing every day, but not quite. You know, that'll probably get him in 130-ish games, something like that. And, you know, that's perfectly fine. And my guess is if he can continue to show good discipline and good power, you know, he should probably carry an 800-ish OPS this year. And I think, you know, that's on the top end of what we probably could expect out of Mark Hakus. So I really don't think we're going to see much of a drop-off offensively. It just doesn't appear that way.
Well, Snyder can get to that level offensively and be anywhere near average defensively, that's a fine combination. Looks like right now he's on pace for about 400 at bat. We'll see if that picks up. As far as Young, your eyes definitely aren't deceiving you. I don't know if you saw the story. I know you're going to get into Brady Anderson a bit later in the show, but Young did spend some time working with Anderson. He wanted to reclaim some of the athleticism he had as a prospect coming up. You know, he was first pick overall with the Rays at one point. And they said he really had picked up some of his speed, especially you know, in the 10-yard sprint. So you combine that a little bit running a little bit better, and like you said, he does have an accurate arm, so he has the opportunity to potentially get a few more games in the outfield this year. And I guess his playing time will obviously be determined by his bat more than anything else. Moving on in the outfield there, you know, obviously Adam Jones had a, you know, fantastic April yesterday, or yeah, yesterday he had four hits, wound up having the game winner. I see some people that are beginning to make the argument that there have been significant adjustments for Jones. And while I am quite a fan of Jones, I'm not quite ready to say that. How about you?
Well, you are seeing him a little bit more patient to me. But again, Adam Jones has gone through these stretches before where he's been really good, and he's shown patience and things like that. Now, the one thing I will say that I've seen from him this year that I don't recall seeing in the past, when he has gone after those low and away pitches, he has visibly upset at himself. Whereas in the past, it was just kind of like, yeah, this is what I do. So I don't know what's changed. I don't, you know, I asked the question the other, you know, going back to Manny for a second, I asked the question today about Machado. Are we seeing a guy who is maturing at the plate who is just getting more experience and a better understanding of what's going on? Or is Scott Coolball the new hitting coach? Is he teaching something? Is he pressing something that just wasn't pushed on these guys in the past? That's no shot at a guy like Jim Presley or anything like that. It's just a mere question. Is Coolball trying? Is he teaching stuff, or is he, you know, is this just something that he is making a much bigger deal out of than it has been in the past? And I kind of wonder, because we're seeing some of these guys that have not been patient in the past be more patient, and I just kind of wonder if there's something there. So I'm with you. I'm not ready to say Jones has changed his approach. He's done anything, but I am seeing him. So far, he has shown a willingness to walk, which in the past he said, I don't get paid to walk. And he has shown a willingness to be upset at going after these pitches, where in the past it didn't seem like it really bothered him all that much.
Well, he's got 5 walks and 12 Ks already this year, which is a far better ratio than what he had last year. He maintains that at that level. He's going to have probably his best year so far in the majors. And yesterday, when he did have the 2-run single knocking in the game-winning runs, he had got down a couple strikes in count. They were trying to bury him low and away. He was able to foul off the pitch, keeping the bat going, and then he was able to hold. I mean, you want to hope that there has been some progression there, either for him or from Coolball, providing some additional guidance. And my just main takeaway is every year Jones has scorching months. Just last June he had a month where he had an OPS over 1,000, and then it's coupled with months where he's just frigid and he has trouble making contact. This happened to start the year here in April and in the early May, and there's a lot of optimism about, you know, this being a new precedent for Jones. It'll be interesting to see, but definitely a good point there about Coolball and wondering if it's an adjustment for the team, for Jones and the team overall.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see. And to me, if Adam Jones shows good plate discipline or better plate discipline, if he's walking 40, 50 times, because early in his Orioles career, he did that. And he showed that he could walk that many times. I still won't believe that he is changed until he does it again next year. You know, it's one of those things where when you're, you know, there are plenty of players who in one season do something that they have never done before in their careers, and then they revert back to what they did do before. That happens all the time. The Orioles, we saw it with Chris Davis last year, what he was in 2013 and the difference in 2014. So it can happen. I want to see it more, but it's at least nice to see. But again, I'm with you. Let's see him do it for the month of May, like he did it for April, and then let's see him do it in June, and let's just see this continue. I think for a guy like Machado, while Coolball might be teaching things that, you know, that and whatnot that weren't pushed on these guys in the past, I think this is also a guy maturing. I just happened to see. I haven't had a chance to really read it. I just posted on the Baltimore Sports and Life message board. Jeff Sullivan from Fangraphs wrote a great article on Manny's discipline, talking about how it looks like the light bulb is turned on for him, and he did a lot of different images from PitchFX and things like that. So it looks like it's an article definitely worth reading and definitely worth checking out. But I think that there's a good chance that this is a guy like Machado who's not set in his ways, maybe like a guy like Adam Jones would be, that you would think so. It's Jones being around 30 years old, Manny obviously, you know, still very young in his career. So this is probably more likely a guy that is maturing more and more. I mean, we did see the walk rate go up a little bit last year for Manny from the year before. It wasn't a huge jump. It's like a 1.5% or 2% jump, something like that. I'm trying to think off the top of my head. Not a huge jump, but it was an improvement. So you would expect to see that continued improvement and then maybe plateau. If he can get his walk rate up into that 8 to 10% range, you know, that's going to be very, very solid for him and for the Orioles going forward, for sure.
In passing there, you talked about Davis in 13 and Davis in 14. Let's talk about Davis in 15. Basically, if you watch all the games in April, it certainly felt like Davis was struggling mightily. And if you look at the his strikeouts for the month, to date so far, he has 35 strikeouts and 80 at-bats. That was a guy that was struggling to make contact for a lot of the month. Still, going into play tomorrow, he's carrying an OPS of 849. He does have 10 extra base hits. And the average is even, it creeped up over to 263. What are you seeing from Davis, and what are you expecting from him for the rest of the year?
Well, he's starting to use all fields a little bit more over the last few weeks, which is definitely shown up in his overall statistics. I think early on you were seeing a guy that was chasing everything, and that's what happened to him last year. I don't really care that much about the strikeouts, as long as the strikeouts are also going to be coming with a solid walk rate, at which it's okay right now. I'd like to see it more. I mean, even last year he was at 11.4, and the year before it was 10.7. So I would like to see it improve. Right now it's at 8.7. I would prefer the strikeout rate. In 2013, it was 29.6%. Last year it was 33%. I would prefer it to be more in that range and just making more contact. but he's swinging at as many bad pitches now as he was early on in the season. And you're starting to see him maybe getting back to where, not necessarily, he's not going to probably get back to where he was in 2013, but if he can be in that 2012, in between 2012-2013, that's a huge boost to this team. So I think, a big deal is going to be for him is to lay off the really bad pitches. Don't swing so much at all the balls outside the zone, which is actually that outside the zone swing percentage right now is actually one of the better ones in his career. I didn't look at and see what it was, say, 2.5 weeks ago, so I don't know if it's really come down in the last few weeks or not. He's swinging and missing basically at the same percentage, the same rate he always has. The contact rate is basically the same. So he's not – a lot of those type of statistics really aren't any different than what they've always been in his career. It's just you're also in a small sample size of at-bats right now, so if you've got a bunch of strikeouts, it makes things look worse versus, now maybe over the next 30 games, if he doesn't strike out, if he strikes out, 75% of 75% of that, three-quarters of the time, of the same amount of strikeouts, I mean, then all of a sudden his strikeout rate, everything looks much more normalized than it does right now. So I think you have to feel pretty good. Davis is always a better hitter when he's using all fields. He showed that in 2013. He's got to go to left field. He can't just be exclusively a pull hitter. And when he's doing that, he is a much better hitter and much more valuable to this team.
Yeah, I agree with you across the board. A number of points there. Definitely about using all fields. He's one of the only players in baseball that has true 80 power, and he has it to all fields. And when he uses when he's willing to use all fields, he can go out anywhere and he can do damage anywhere. The fact that he's got an 850 OPS right now, pretty optimistic of what he can do the rest of the year. I do think the walk rate will go up. The K's, they're going to be there when he's struggling. He's another guy that you could throw up a beach ball when he's struggling and he'll have struggle to make contact. When he's going well, he'll hit a bit of everything. But I think that, I went into the year expecting him to be between 2012 and 2013, and I feel pretty good right now about him reaching that level. Let's talk about a couple of the starters. One of the guys you were excited to see going into the year was Jimenez. And, you've been touting him as, I believe, the AL Comeback Player of the Year. Now going into May, still feeling good about that pick. Obviously, he's pitched well so far to start the year.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I think you have to go back to what they did with him at the end of last year, where they really tried to simplify his windup. He still has a very quirky windup, but the fact that he's not going above his head anymore, I kind of liken that a little bit to a golf swing. If you have a very long backswing, there is more of a chance for things to screw up as you're coming through. So this is kind of a similar principle here. So Jimenez taking away, putting the arms above the head, it's taking away of another second or something where something could get screwed up there. So I think that that's pretty big. His velocity seems to be a little bit better this year. I haven't, I'm seeing a lot more in that 90 to 92 range, it seems like, when we're watching him pitch, which I don't think Jimenez showed last year. As bad as he was last year, he was still missing bats and he was still striking out. The guy there has been in the past last year did not. Velocity actually this year is actually lower than last year. I'm actually surprised by that. By PitchFX, they're saying it's 90 exactly in last year.
I've seen his velocity been down, but I think the movement is somehow even been better this year. And most importantly, what you were saying, about the mechanics, a little bit simpler, a little bit more accurate. And I think he's been working quicker. Which helps as well.
Yes.
And now it's just a matter of every fifth day when he goes out there, can he sustain that and be, last year he had the worst walk percentage of his career. And I think we all were kind of in line that if he got that back to his career norms, he would have a chance to be successful. So certainly encouraging there. I had jumped away from the offense, but going back for one second, I'd like to discuss Joseph and Wieters. So, Wieters does figure to return at some point. Joseph was playing well. I thought he might be overwhelmed offensively, but he's rebounded and has been on a nice run for several weeks now. Defensively, if you believe in the pitch framing metrics, last year he was exceptional. It looks like there's some metrics out already for this year that are showing him to be positive again. The throwing hasn't been quite as good as last year, but I guess you also have to factor in the pitchers and their what they've done holding runners. How do you exactly handle that? Wieters comes back. Let's say Wieters is ready to go June 1st, and let's say Joseph hasn't completely fallen off offensively. How does playing time go the rest of the year for you?
Well, Wieters, to me, still has to go back. Joseph right now has a .414 on base percentage, which is just insane to think. And he's got an .889 OPS. He's got a WRC plus of .147.
It's not sustainable.
That's not sustainable for him. He's got a .364 batting average of balls in play. That's not happening. But I will say this: he does not look like he's overwhelmed or overmatched. If 2 years ago, maybe not even 2 years ago, maybe last year in the beginning of the year, and in fact, definitely last year in the beginning of the year, if somebody were to tell you that Caleb Joseph was a guy that could be pushing Matt Wieters to be the starting catcher on this team, they would have laughed at you. I remember. On this show, we had an exchange with Britt Giroli saying, when she said, you cannot replace Matt Wieters. You cannot trade him. You cannot replace him. Well, Caleb Joseph has been replacing him. And I don't blame her for not seeing that. Who the heck would have seen that coming? But the point is you haven't missed that much of a beat, especially this year. You could maybe argue that last year Wieters would have given you more offensively, especially with the way that he was showing an improvement from the left side of the plate with his hands lowered. So, they might have been a better team last year even without him, with him. But Joseph still was fine last year. I mean, he had like about a 1.5-ish WAR in half of a season. And then this year he's been fantastic. So I think to answer your question, you probably – this will allow you to DH Wieters more if you choose to put two catchers in the same time. This will allow you to rest Wieters maybe and rest his arm a little bit more than maybe you thought you would. You figure he shouldn't need a lot of rest per se because he's going to miss a decent part of the beginning of the season. But I also do think that you do have to look to the future and say, okay, we're hoping that Weeders does enough this year that we can give him a qualifying offer and, you know, we're able to get a draft pick for him. What I do wonder is if Joseph continues to play well and you get Weeders back and Weeders is also playing well, is there an opportunity there where you say maybe we look to trade Weeders in the, at the deadline? That to me could be a very intriguing scenario for this team. I know Orioles fans don't want to hear about trading somebody, and I'm talking even if they're contending. I know Orioles fans don't necessarily want to hear that, but if you're going to lose Weeders anyway, and somebody's going to present to you a package that is pretty tough to give to say no to, and you have a young catcher who is going to probably be your starting catcher for the future, it's tough to kind of turn that down, especially considering the pitchers do love throwing to Joseph. And, you know, and you don't know how Weeder's arm is going to be with the Tommy John. So I think that's an interesting scenario that is something to really keep an eye on as this season goes on.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of different variables there. I do think when Weeders, whenever he does get back to the majors, I think the Orioles going to have to be, unless the plan does wind up becoming the DH more, I think they're going to have to be convinced that his arm is ready to go. But we'll see what happens there. It's definitely something to watch. As we wrap up the Orioles conversation, I know we had alluded to it earlier. I wanted to get your thoughts on the other Fangraphs article we saw in recent days, Orioles related. This a Q&A with Orioles VP of Baseball Operations, Brady Anderson. Just some takeaways that you had from that.
I took away two things. The first thing was, and actually they're both kind of in the same thing, talking about what was going on with Duquette this offseason. The first thing is, part of me says, see you later, Duquette. The second thing is, why were the Orioles reportedly, now, you know, reports being what they are, we don't know if they're 100% accurate, but reportedly they were talking about, you know, if Duquette were to leave, we were hearing names like Omar Minaya and Kevin Towers and Ned Colletti. Why would they even consider that when it appears to me that you have the guy to replace him with right now? Brady Anderson really kind of came on my personal radar just listening to him doing games as a color analyst. Now, I know that that's not the greatest way to judge somebody, but I personally did not think Mike Flanagan was casted right in the role of GM in the beginning, and part of that reasoning was because of what I would hear him say in commentary. That's, you know, it's their beliefs, it's their thought processes. Brady was kind of the opposite. He seemed like he was somebody that you could really put into that role, and he would not be overwhelmed by it, and his ideas were definitely a, quote, new school type thinking. And, you know, with the way that you read this article, he gets it. He understands it. And I would, right now, if Dan Duquette left tomorrow for Toronto, I would have zero doubt that Brady Anderson could step right in and do as good a job or better job. Because there are some things that I think Duquette has done great. Overall, I think he's a little overvalued by the Orioles fans. I think Brady could actually be somebody who puts this organization in position to where they could actually be a legitimate contender every year. Because right now, I kind of doubt the organization long-term once we get beyond this offseason, assuming we lose certain guys and all. I think Brady Anderson is the type of baseball mind that can take this organization to the next level. And, you know, stuff like free agent contracts and stuff like that, he'll learn that. He'll put guys around him that can learn, you know, that can teach him, that can help him with that kind of stuff. So I'm not really concerned about that. I'm more concerned about the structure of the organization, what your vision is, and things like that. And I think Brady Anderson has got he seems like he gets it, and that article really highlighted that to me.
He's an interesting, introspective guy. Obviously, he's somebody that he's renowned for his fitness and the regimen there. Where you're seeing that Fangraphs article is another side of him, the intellectual side, and of how he used analytics as a player to set up pitchers and, frankly, to advance his career. And now he's taken that as an executive, somebody that still interacts with the players a lot. Now he's had a couple of years of working hand-in-hand with Duquette and seeing the game from that side. You have to wear a lot of hats as an executive. You would wonder if he has the background for handling, you know, contract negotiations and stuff, but you can always have a staff that you build out. Based off everybody else that we know internally and based on what we've seen, he certainly looks like the best best candidate that exists internally to replace Duquette if such a need arises. Definitely an interesting article. Encourage people to check that out. Fangraphs.com if you haven't already seen it. We also have a link to it at our message board at BSL. So now we're going to get to the Ravens. Go ahead and, you know, take a quick break, and we'll come back on the other side.
Baltimore Sports and Life is dedicated to the analysis and discussion of the Baltimore Orioles,
the Baltimore Ravens,
and the University of Maryland.
The site has a team of writers providing coverage of those teams
and houses live streaming content weekly. Join the conversations at the message board,
like BSL on Facebook,
and follow BSL on Twitter.
BSL is part of 24/7 Networks
with Russell Street Report and Utah Street Report.
Okay, and we're back. So we're going to transition over to the other Baltimore team, and I don't mean the Blast, and that is the Ravens. Obviously, we just had the NFL draft this past weekend. By all accounts, the Ravens had another draft where they knocked it out of the park by all the analysts and things like that. So, Chris, let's just start it off from the first pick. What were your thoughts on the Perryman pick?
Well, I think I was more excited about the pick than most of BSL's Raven analysts. I saw the same thing about his drops, and I guess at some level of concern there, and also his route running. But you can't teach speed, and I'm not of the opinion that speed is overrated. I do think route running matters. I do think, obviously, you have to have hands as a receiver, but I think you have to have diversity among your receivers as far as a skill set. I think Flacco's best attribute, maybe outside of his ability, his durability, is his arm strength. I think having somebody to challenge defenses deep, pulling off that coverage, allows you to have more opportunities for plays underneath. So, yeah, I was pretty excited about getting Perryman there. We've talked all winter about need to add weapons to Flacco. I know we'll get into Max Williams as well, but yeah, they upgraded their weapons there. A Perryman pick. It's not one that has no concern, you know, but it's, you know, I'm excited to see what he can do. And as somebody that argued for Torrey Smith's return, this was a good argument against that. You got a guy with some similar skills, similar speed, similar size, another guy who can stretch the field, and he's going to cost a lot less in this rookie contract than Torrey would have in an extension. So, you know, it made sense to me, and you know, I'm looking forward to seeing him get out on the field and seeing what he can do in Trestman's offense.
Yeah, I think he's got a higher upside than Torrey does. You know, here's the thing. This was not a good draft in the first round. I mean, people need to remember that. If Perryman busts, there weren't a whole lot of other options. We heard the Ravens say that if they could have traded back, if Perryman wasn't there, they would have tried to trade back. We don't know that somebody was going to trade up with them. We don't know for sure that they would have been able to have it. So their other option would have been to draft a guy like Byron Jones, who maybe they didn't really like that much, or to draft that guy, Malcolm Brown, who the Patriots got. I think that could have been a good pick there. But then they get Davis in the third round, and Davis might be just as good as Malcolm Brown is. He just maybe is a little more inconsistent in the college level. So they went with a very high-end boom or bust pick. Now, the one thing that I do think about is, what is the difference between Perryman in the first round and the Steelers getting Sammy Coates in the third round? I think that you can sit there and say, well, those are two very similar guys. You know, route running is in question, hands are questioned. But the one thing that seems to stand out about Perryman is Perryman is not a guy that people are necessarily questioning his hands. They're questioning his concentration and focus 100% of the time on the field, and that's the reason that balls were dropped. And I think that that is a huge distinction between do you have good hands or do you have bad concentration. I would much rather have the receiver who has good, soft hands but just isn't focused all the time. You can change the focus, okay? Put the second contract in front of him, and all of a sudden that focus will come into light. So I'm not – I think it's telling that a guy like Bobby Engram, who seems to be a pretty impressive coach based on the things that we've heard, he's pounding the table, get this guy. I saw Michael Irvin on NFL Network talk about that this is a guy that made huge plays on third and fourth down. He's a guy that you want to go to. Yes, I am somebody who would rather have – who values the route running, values the guy that catches the ball, a Jordan Matthews-type guy, somebody I really wanted last year. I really value those guys highly. But if you can get a guy that can give you the size-speed combination that Perryman can, and you feel that he's really not that far off – I mean, there are some people that think that he really has the ability to be the best receiver in this draft, or at least right there with Cooper and White. So – And Parker. So I don't have any problem with the pick, especially when you consider that this was a very weak draft in that 18 to 40 range. And then the other guy, too, that I really like was Jalen Strong, but you saw him drop to 70. So it really makes you wonder, is there something going on there? You know, we heard about the wrist. We also heard the way he disclosed the wrist injury, didn't want it tested, things like that. That kind of turned some teams off. So the fact that, you know, that they didn't take him there, and the fact that nobody else was taking him when he was a top 20 player on most people's boards, I think it's a little telling that there was something else going on there that maybe the draft pundits and all didn't realize was the case. So I don't have any problem with them taking him. I fully understand that this could be a bust of a pick, but it's also the 26th pick in the first round in a weak draft in terms of first round talent. So I think you have to take each situation, you know, on a case-by-case basis. Like, people talk about that Mark Clayton was a bust. Mark Clayton wasn't a bust. He was the 23rd pick in the first round of that draft, and he did some good things, and he helped the team. He wasn't a bust. He wasn't a tremendous home run like the Ravens usually have in the first round, but he wasn't a bust. So I think you have to take things in a case-by-case situation. And, you know, if Perryman was out of the league in 3 years, it wouldn't shock me. But if he's a perennial Pro Bowler, it wouldn't shock me either. So I think the Ravens just went with the upside. I don't have any problem with that.
Yeah, a couple things there. I mean, Perryman basically echoed your thought. He definitely said it has been a concentration issue and trying to make the big play every time. He also says that the questions about his hand have put a chip on his shoulder, and you know it's going to motivate him going forward. So yeah, we'll see. This also transitions into his job, and it's now something that he's going to be concentrating on, you know, basically 24/7 instead of whatever attention it receives while you're at school. Also, this is a guy that from the combine on was basically mocked in the top 15 pretty much by everybody. So, again, they got the Ravens stayed later part of the first round and got essentially value with a guy that has a skill set, that has the potential to be an impact player. Based on what the Ravens had going into the draft and what they're leaving, I'm excited about the pick.
Yeah, and you hit on it earlier. To me, everybody wanted to talk about the secondary. No. To me, the biggest issue on this team was a lack of playmakers. Now you can put a guy in the secondary and you want more playmaking ability out of the secondary. That's fine. But overall, this team needed playmakers. You know, they saw Pitta go down last year. Owen Daniels did an adequate job, but Owen Daniels, you know, he was an adequate replacement, but he wasn't a playmaking guy for the most part. You know, so you add Perryman, and then in the second round you add Max Williams, who everybody agreed was the best tight end in the draft. The Ravens traded up. They got ahead of the Steelers, who that people were kind of thinking that the Steelers would have taken him, especially with Heath Miller getting older. The Ravens maybe thought that, so they gave up a fifth when they had those picks to spare. They jumped up. They got the guy that they wanted. It's the guy that's been compared to you know, the Todd Heaps and Jason Wittens and all that. Basically, he's been compared to all the really good white tight ends. That just seems to be the way that always works out for some reason. But just a coincidence. But you know, I saw a couple sites say he's not overly athletic, and I saw some that said he was athletic. The bottom line is he's a guy who can get down the seam. He can make plays. He's a big guy. I think, you know, you have to – I love the pick. You know, it was a definite need. I think it – I sent a question on Twitter to Jeff Cerebiak from the Baltimore Sun, who covers the Ravens, and he said that, you know, people pretty much have a good understanding that it's, you know, whether it's Pitta won't play anymore or it's going to be very difficult for him to just stay on the field even if he tries to play. I think the Ravens obviously feel that way since they also drafted a blocking tight end later on in the draft and a guy who can maybe be a short to intermediate weapon for them as the time goes on. But it looks like they're transitioning to an all very young tight end group. I know they also have liked Philip Supernaw in the past. I got to think that he's either going to be on another team or the practice squad next year. I would guess that they would prefer Boyle over him, although I'm not 100% on that. But
you certainly wouldn't trust Pitta to stay on the field. And then you look at the rest of the skill position. It's a bunch of guys to like and not a whole lot to love. So they had to upgrade tight end. They did that. They got the best catching tight end in the draft. That's a significant upgrade. They got a receiver that could stretch the field. Now, I might have had interest if it was possible of falling back into the second and taking Smith from Ohio State and getting that same type of guy. But the Ravens went with the guy that they preferred, and I don't have a problem with that. As far as Williams, you know, like you said, he's compared to every other white tight end for the last 15 years. But, you know, it looks to be a guy that another guy for tight end that has some level of athleticism, and compared to what the Ravens had coming into the draft with Gilmore and Supernaw, you leave the draft feeling a lot better about where you are. And I think that's basically similar to what the Ravens are year after year, where they never go into a season with major deficiencies. They might have things that go wrong for them, but they usually find some type of answer going into a year.
Yeah, and you know, going back to Devin Smith for a second, I you know, he's apparently amazing at tracking the deep ball. Mike Mayock said he's one of the best he's seen in 20 years. But the one thing I will say, he was, 2 inches shorter? The Ravens obviously wanted that size and speed combination with Perriman. I have no problem with that. I'd prefer the bigger receiver myself. I like what we saw out of Crockett Gilmore last year. I questioned that pick last year, not because I questioned the player, but questioned where they took him. There were a lot of people that thought you could have gotten him a round or two later. Maybe those people were right, maybe they weren't. The bottom line is the Ravens got the guy that they liked, and he showed pretty decent last year, especially as the year went on. And the other thing that you liked about Max Williams was his grading on blocking. You know, this is not just a pass-catching guy. This is a guy who can block. You know, Pro Football Focus, you know, they were doing their grades on these college guys, and he graded as one of the top three blocking tight ends in with run blocking and stuff. So this is not just
a
pass-catching guy.
Yeah, that's a great point. I liked Gilmore, too. I just don't want to go into the year having to, like, really rely on him to be the safety valve. And now you have another option, which is, if you're Flacco, you have to be excited about that.
Yeah, and it's not just another option. It's an option that's, where he's pushing 6'5". And Flacco, they talk about tall quarterbacks, throw it, you know, they like the taller receivers. The ball comes out high a lot with Joe. You know, it just does. It's part of the mechanics. It's part of being a tall quarterback. So having a big target, bigger targets, you know that he likes that. I remember the thing with the Steelers a few years ago where Hines Ward kind of was a little upset that Roethlisberger wanted a taller target. But Roethlisberger's a big guy, and, you know, Hines Ward's, you know, in football terms, he was a little midget running around out there. He was productive, but he wanted a bigger guy. And, you know, we know over the years the Ravens have struggled in the red zone. Having a bigger target is important, and it's good to see. And then the Ravens also, to address the running back situation, I was surprised by the Buck Allen pick. I don't – as I started reading more, Aaron Wilson talked about how they brought David Cobb in. They liked David Cobb. It seemed like, you know, that there were sources that said that they really liked him. He was sitting there and they didn't take him. Allen was a guy, when as soon as I saw his highlights running when they drafted him, I immediately thought of Bernard Pierce. And then I saw later on that one of the websites was comparing him to Bernard Pierce. He has an upright style, which I don't usually like. A lot of times that leads to ball security problems. But I think he only fumbled like 4 or 5 times in his college career. He caught like 60 balls one of the college years. Very productive college player. Bill Polian talked about he's a guy that you may look at. Yep, one cut runner, better in the NFL than in college. So to me the thing is this: the Ravens, there were running backs on the board that the Ravens reportedly had private workouts for, and they still didn't take those guys. They took Allen. I'm not going to question the Ravens on a running back pick. They generally speaking hit on their running back picks. Bernard Pierce flamed out a little bit when he first came onto the scene. He looked like he was going to be a really good pick. Then he had injuries and he had some fumbling issues and that kind of stuff. So he got kind of put in the doghouse. But for the most part, they do a really good job with their picks. So I'm not going to flame. If they feel that was the guy, despite bringing in other guys for private workouts, then I have no problem with that. But they had to continue to add skill positions, so I was glad to see them do that too.
Well, they bring in Allen, and I'm interested to see him and Taliaferro in camp. I mean, you would figure that, you know, Forsett's going to get his carries, but then you'd kind of like a little bit more of a thumper behind them. And we'll see which one of those two really emerge. Taliaferro, obviously having the year of experience in front of him, but Allen will have his opportunities as well. Of course, they also, you know, in the third, looking on the defensive side, they also made a few additions. Speaking of big men, they got, obviously, Carl Davis there in the third round. Obviously, we've seen the national story multiple times about the glaring hole for the Ravens after losing Nada. Of course, we all saw locally how Williams played all year, and then Jernigan, how he played in Nada's absence during the suspension last fall. But if anything, you've added further depth behind them, and you don't have to go into camp relying on Urban, who missed all of last year, and Lewis Moore, who's missed the last 2 years, to return to the line. So you've added additional depth to the line there with somebody that was a pretty high-end prospect in his own right.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they brought back Canty, and then you have Lawrence Guy. But, I mean, it's funny, among the guys who are going to be regulars, it's like Brandon Williams is like the oldest guy on the defensive line right now. I mean, they just have nothing but this young, athletic, dominant level talent on that defensive line. It's pretty ridiculous. I mean, some of the stuff they were talking about Carl Davis, most people said he's a top 40, top 50 player. Some people thought he could get into the bottom of the first round. He had consistency issues. But here's the thing about the Ravens. If they bring in a guy with a dominant skill set that or has shown a dominant skill set, I feel pretty good. I mean, how many linemen on the defensive side of the ball have they brought in that have not worked out? You know, I mean, they've been few and far between. I mean, Terrence Cody obviously did not work out, but they just don't develop those guys. So you've got to feel pretty good about them taking a guy like Carl Davis, another guy like Za'Darius Smith, who, you know, looks to like he can be basically Courtney Upshaw's replacement after this year, because you're not going to give Courtney Upshaw a big contract.
Harbaugh calling him the replacement for
McPhee.
Yeah, both Davis and Smith, I mean, you've added guys to your rotation who, you know, not a ton's going to be dependent on them here in 15, but they're part of the rotation. They get experience, and as you said, you have additional young legs, and you can build them up, and that's always pretty exciting to watch.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, and then the one pick that people were kind of like, whoa, who is this guy? The Trey Walker pick in the fourth round. He's a big corner, a lot of speed. People thought that maybe he was only a 6th round pick. However, there was talk that he was getting on people's boards late and that he was starting to move up people's boards. So I think the Ravens saw, first of all, we've got a lot of picks in this draft. We're going to, maybe even the Ravens would say, you know what, we've reached a little bit for this, but we see a big corner with a lot of skills, and we see a lot of upside with this kid. So, you know what, we're going to take him because this is a player that we want, and we want to make sure we get him. So even if you want to say they extended a little bit, a round or two more on a kid like that, I don't have as much of a problem. It was a comp pick. You know, you had the picks in the fifth round. It looks like, you know, in the fifth round they got one of the offensive linemen that they got was a guy that they really liked, that they Juan Castillo said was one of his favorite players in his draft. So they really liked him. In the sixth round they ended up getting the guy Waller from Georgia Tech. He's a complete developmental guy. It's just, let's just see what we get. He's a 6'6" receiver from Georgia Tech, and you know, maybe you get lucky. And you know, so I don't have a problem with taking Walker in the bottom of the fourth round because he's a guy that you liked and a guy that was really getting on some team's radar. So I think overall they address the areas that they need to address. I would still like to see them add a veteran third corner. I was really hoping to see a Boykin trade in this draft. The Eagles added three corners, so you do want in the draft, so you do wonder if he's going to be available. That's the one thing that I see right now is I'd like to see a third corner in case one of your two top guys, in case one of them who are injury prone goes down, you have somebody who's got a little bit more experience to come in and start.
I would definitely echo the thoughts about another veteran corner. But my primary takeaway, if you look at the roster, both sides of the ball, and you think this is now the going to be the third year after the last Super Bowl, they've really turned over the roster. And mm-hmm. There's a lot of young legs. It's a lot of guys that have a chance to be part of this next core for several years. And, of course, they're coming off another winning season, and they're going to go into this coming season as, you know, what they've been over the last, over more than half a decade, which is a perennial contender in the AFC. So, the draft has me excited for the start of football, and looking forward to the next wave of articles coming out from our BSL Ravens analyst colleagues as they start to look over the roster and get their thoughts.
Well, they continue to understand how to build a football team. Everybody wants to talk about it's a passing era and you know, get the wide receiver. And I get that. But you still build a football team from the inside out. And the Ravens still understand that. They get that. And, you know, you look at this. Look at the defense right now. Okay, you've just locked up Jimmy Smith, so you've got the really young corner. Unfortunately, you have Terrence Brooks, who's going to be out for a good part of the season. I really would have loved to have seen him get a full season this year, so that's going to push him back. But you've got young safeties, you've got young linebackers, you're young up front, except for you got the veterans in Suggs and Doomerville and Canty on the line. But everybody else is young. I mean, basically you have Suggs, Doomerville, and Webb as your elder statesman and Canty, so to speak, and then everybody else is like under 25 years old. You know, this is like the complete opposite of what the Steelers were doing for the last few years, where they kept bringing back the Brett Keisels and the Polamalus and all those guys. The Ravens are getting rid of all those guys, and they're just getting younger, faster, and more athletic and stronger. And that's going to turn into dominance at some point. I mean, if this guy Carl Davis develops, and you've got what Brandon Williams did last year, you got what Jernigan showed last year, and you've got what we have on the ends rushing, and then you got Mosley in the center. I don't know how teams. First of all, nobody's going to run the ball on the Ravens next year. And, you know, quarterbacks are just going to be in a lot of trouble. So I really look forward to seeing what this team is going to do. And I think people are really underrating. Everybody's looking at, like, the Colts right now because they added, you know, these veteran guys. The Colts' defense still isn't any good, and their offensive line still isn't that good. So, you know, I have a lot of confidence in the Ravens. If they're going up against the Colts team that everybody loves, that they'll be able to kind of push them around a little bit. So, we'll see how Perryman develops. We'll see how Max Williams develops and everything else. You know, if those weapons can come on, the Ravens could really, really push forward and be, you know, maybe the best team in the AFC next year. I really don't think that's out of the realm of possibility.
Warmed up today, 80-some degrees, and you can just feel that July and the training camp right around the corner at this point.
Yeah, no doubt. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back, and we're going to hit a little bit of the NBA talk. Be right back.
Baltimore Sports and Life is dedicated to the analysis and discussion of the Baltimore Orioles,
the Baltimore Ravens,
and the University of Maryland.
The site has a team of writers providing coverage of those teams
and houses live streaming content weekly. Join the conversations at the message board, like BSL on Facebook, and follow BSL on Twitter. BSL is part of 24/7 Networks with Russell Street Report and Utah Street Report.
Okay, and welcome back. This past Saturday, we obviously had the great sports day with the derby, with the really horrible boxing match, and probably the event of the day was Game 7 between the Clippers and the Spurs. Chris Paul got the hamstring injury early. He was able to play through it. I saw he's not supposed to play tonight. Doc Rivers has ruled him out, but he was able to get the game-winning shot. I think to me the takeaway from this is, you know, the question that can be asked is, have we seen the last of the Spurs as a dynasty type team? I think we always want to ask that question of this team. It seems like it's been asked several times over the last 15 years. I'm not willing to say it's over for them. Duncan is still playing well. We'll see what happens with Parker and Ginobili. Ginobili is obviously not the player he was, and Parker was hurt in this postseason. So we'll see. But that seems to be the question that people are asking. Chris, do you have any thoughts on that real quick before we move on to the second round games?
Yeah, first, I would have thought the biggest thing on Saturday would have been you entering your late 30s, but obviously Game 7, Spurs and Clippers, that was a great series. The Clippers, a little bit more athleticism, obviously, with they're in their front court. Timmy couldn't get off the ground at all, but he still played great in Game 7. Paul, he got hurt in Game 7. He pulled, you know, little Isaiah Thomas, looked like a Thomas versus the Lakers back in that finals, gutting it out and playing well, and especially down the stretch. Of course, for the Spurs, they had Parker, who had his own injury issues, and he was kind of hobbled throughout the series. Yeah, Ginobili has moments, but it's hard for him to sustain anything over a game. If Duncan comes back, you still have a nice piece there. Popovich will get him the appropriate rest, and you have Leonard, a top-10 player in the game with a capable bench. I think they have to find a little bit more athleticism for probably some of the depth of their roster, and particularly inside. But that was a great series. I thought the Spurs would get to the Western Conference Finals. I was tempted to even pick them over Golden State, to pick Golden State over them. But that was a great series, and we'll see what L.A. Can do next as they move on.
Yeah, first of all, I have to correct you. 36 is still considered the mid-30s, so I'm not in my upper 30s yet. So I need to correct that. And the most important thing is that my wonderful wife spent the night until 3 a.m. cleaning out my car because I drank a little too much and had some issues because of that. So the Spurs, the thing that I heard before the series started is, will they be able to handle the athleticism of the Clippers? And just as would a guy like Kawhi Leonard be able to shut down Chris Paul because of his great defense? You know, it was a very, very close series. I think I had the Spurs winning the championship this year. I thought it was going to be between them and Golden State. I was taking the idea of the Spurs pedigree plus Kawhi Leonard being able to guard the Klay Thompsons and the Steph Currys and Chris Pauls and stuff like that. And I was thinking that advantage, kind of a la LeBron against Derrick Rose in the past and stuff like that, would be kind of the difference. I'm kind of all in on Golden State now because I thought that it was either them or San Antonio.
The biggest thing for San Antonio was that they didn't close out in game six.
Yep. Yeah, that's where they lost.
All right, and they had to go back out to L.A. Series could have gone either way, but L.A. moves on.
Yeah, so they're moving on, and they're going to play Houston. As I said, Chris Paul has been ruled out for tonight. That's a game, if you're Houston, you got to win. There's no other way around it. Houston has their injuries. You can't lose to the Clippers with their best player and the guy that makes them go at home without him being on the court. Got to win game one tonight. That's going to be a pretty good series. I think I would favor the Clippers in that series, but I don't know what Chris Paul's status is going to be from game to game. So I think with that not being sure, maybe you do give a slight edge to Houston. But I think if Chris Paul is able to play in game two and he's healthy throughout the rest of the series, then I feel pretty good about the Clippers. But, you know, I don't know that right now. But I think that is going to be the key to the series, is how is his health going to be and how much is he going to be able to play.
Well, yeah, the Rockets do have to win tonight if Paul's out, and especially with L.A. playing a long-draining series and Houston having additional time to rest. I mean, that's a game you have to win. To me, a key to that series is Dwight Howard kind of negating Jordan and Griffin inside. He has to do his share inside and be the equal partner there of Harden. That's an interesting series. We'll see if some of the other players for Houston, particularly Terrence Jones and Ariza, if they can provide some, and like a Josh Smith, if they can provide some level of consistent production.
Yeah, it's a shame that there's not any that Patrick Beverley's not playing and Houston's not at full strength, because I Houston is probably a team that's a little underrated coming into these playoffs. They have. Obviously, they can be a very strong team, you know, but you know, with some of the injuries and things like that, it really hurts them. In the other Western Conference series, you have Golden State against Memphis. Golden State is already up 1-0. to me, the key in this series is going to be Memphis's ability to score. Memphis is a good defensive team, but I think they're going to struggle to keep Golden State under 100 points. Golden State might be able to keep them in the mid-90s or something like that, but for the most part, I'm assuming Golden State is going to get into the hundreds. And the question is, will Memphis be able to score enough with or without Mike Conley? See how that goes. But will they be able to score enough against a very good Golden State defense? That's where I think that they get hurt. They can hurt Golden State with some size. They can hurt them with, you know, some physical play. But I just don't think that they'll be able to score enough to win four games in this series. I think they can maybe win a game or two, but I just don't see them being able to win this series. I just don't think they can score enough.
Yeah, I totally agree. I like Memphis a lot as a team. Gasol and Randolph have been a nice interior combination. I like the acquisition of Jeff Green. Courtney Lee is an okay kind of role player. Vince Carter still has something left as a reserve, but and Mike Conley, he's been a nice one of the better point guards in the league. But even if he was at full strength, and let's say he is for game two, I just they're not going to put up four wins in that series. I think you can pretty easily move ahead Golden State to the Western Conference Finals.
Okay, I'm going to save Chicago and Cleveland for last. Going to the Atlanta and the Wizards series, I mean, we saw the Wizards win game one last night. We saw Atlanta got pushed by a relatively mediocre Brooklyn team, I think. And we saw, you know, the Wizards just blitz right through Toronto, sweeping that series. I think I still would give the edge to Atlanta in this series, but I think, and I said it before, I think that the Wizards have a legitimate chance to win this series, and obviously winning game one certainly helps. But, I mean, this is a team that is playing very well right now, and you know, people thought that the Wizards could get to the Eastern Conference Finals when this season started. They were very up and down this year, but they're playing extremely well right now. And Atlanta has some injury issues, and you know, they look very vulnerable right now. So you know, Atlanta, obviously they've got to win Game Two, I think, for sure. I mean, I guess in theory they could still win the series, but that's, I don't think it's going to happen if they lose. So, but this series is you know, the Wizards really have a very, very good chance of beating Atlanta, who, you know, just right now are not playing great basketball.
I like the Wizards coming into the series to at least push Atlanta, and now with having captured game one, they now become the favorites. Even if Atlanta gets a split at home, I like Washington going back home, even though, that's not a tremendous home court advantage. I didn't see the status on Beal. I know he had hurt his ankle. Like, one key in that series is that with Washington putting out Toronto early, Pierce got some extra rest, and that's a big key for them. Porter's come on a little bit, looking like the third overall pick that he was. They got Nene back. Him and Gortat, that's a nice little combination, especially because neither one of them has to really have the ball go through their hands. They're able to score on putbacks, or they both run well. And Nene, he's doing some rebounding and interior blocking. But they, one of the things I've seen is that in that series against the Raptors, it surprised a lot of people the amount of threes that the Wizards were shooting uncharacteristically high for them. And it looked like that carried over against Atlanta. Atlanta has the four All-Stars this year, plus Carroll, who's played well. That's a good team, and I think that's a good example of why, even though a team that's been consistently kind of in the middle of the Eastern Conference, you don't necessarily just tear it down and just say that you can't win. I think if Atlanta was playing their best ball, that they would have a chance, and they still do, to win this series, get to the conference finals, and potentially play their way into a finals. But they're not playing that well right now. Korver said they turned it on late in their series against the Nets, but that they came out kind of flat to start. I just think right now I'm going to go with the Wizards, and I think the best player on the court in that series is Wall, so I'm going to go with him.
All right, let's go to the final series here, which to me is the most intriguing series of the second round. That is the Bulls and the Cavaliers. Right now, with 2 minutes to go in the game, the Bulls are up 94-88 in Cleveland. Jimmy Butler's got 17 points, 6 assists, 4 rebounds. Derrick Rose has got 25 points, 5 assists, 4 boards. Gasol has got 21-10. When you go to the Cleveland side of things, Kyrie is having a really good game. He's got 30 points, 6 assists. He's 10 for 22 from the field. LeBron is working on a triple-double, 13 rebounds, 7 assists. He only has 19 points, and he's only 9 for 21 shooting, including 0 for 3 from 3. Cleveland, I think, is in a lot of trouble. I think that the Kevin Love loss, now I understand that Kevin Love is not the player in Cleveland that he was in Minnesota, and there are people saying this is not as big a loss as people want to think it is, but I disagree with them. He's still a threat on the court. He's still a good rebounder. You're losing scoring, you're losing rebound, and you're losing, maybe more importantly, that threat out, especially on the outside. I think this is a complete toss-up series. And if I absolutely had to favor a team, I think I would favor the Bulls, especially if they end up holding on tonight. But
I wrote on the board the other day I was taking the Bulls, and I don't really see how you can't, because LeBron and Irving are the two best players left in the Eastern Conference playoffs, and James, even if he was down at all this year, he still has certainly an argument of being the best player on the planet. But you look at the Bulls roster from you take the top 8 players on both teams, it's a pretty easy call to take the Bulls depth. You're looking at, and especially once you have Rose looking like, not like his former MVP self, but not looking like a total stiff. If he's giving you something and you have him and Butler and Gasol and Noah, who's not at his level last year, but he's still gutting it out, and Dunleavy, and then you get Gibson, Mitrovic, or however you pronounce his name. That's and Heinrich. I mean, that's a much better group than what Cleveland has in reserve. They get this win tonight. I mean, you should expect it. I mean, that's losing Love. You can't lose a player like Love and the way Cleveland was built, and that not have an impact. I mean, James is going to have to play out of his mind. Irving is going to have to play out of his mind for them to win that series, I think.
Yeah, and the thing, and you've also, now, Cleveland made some very good trades in the middle of the year. You know, Mozgov is a big help for them defensively and rebounding. Iman Shumpert was a big help. J.R. Smith is a help, but he's missing the first two games of the series because of the suspension. So that's very important. And the one thing that you just mentioned, Kyrie, and you mentioned LeBron, but the thing is that the Bulls can do, the Bulls have Jimmy Butler, and Jimmy Butler is that other guy like Kawhi Leonard and like Paul George that can do it on both ends of the floor in this league. And he's a guy that you can put on LeBron or on Kyrie, and he can help at least slow them down a little bit. Not every team is going to have a player like that on their roster that will be able to defensively be able to hold up a little bit against those guys. So that's a really important point. And, you know, with J.R. Smith out for two games and you don't have Kevin Love, it looks like there's
Tristan
a good chance.
Thompson better play well.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be tough on Cleveland. It really is. And I saw something the other day. I didn't get a chance to read the article, but that Nate Silver's site, they said that Cleveland was still a 70% chance to win, and I just don't see how that can be like that. I mean, I don't even see how it could be 70% if Kevin Love and J.R. Smith were playing the whole series. 70% seems
crazy.
Yeah,
I think if Love is back, it's almost a pick'em series. Without Love, I don't see it. I mean, Mike Miller, who is a – he can still hit some threes open. Sean Marion, who's on his last legs. I like Joe Harris at Virginia. I like Shumpert. Like you said, you had Smith, but you're dealing with him being out right now. I don't see how you can look at that roster and like them better, even when you know that James and Irving are the two best players on the court.
When you look at tonight, right now, they've got three guys who are playing more than 40 minutes and a fourth guy in Tristan Thompson that's playing 37 minutes. So, you know, they're only playing they've got James Jones and Sean Marion have played 14 minutes combined tonight. And Mike Miller has been in for 16 minutes. So they're basically playing six guys, with Mike Miller sprinkled in a little bit. Now, obviously, when J.R. Smith gets back, he'll play. But they're not going as deep as Chicago is, and their main guys have to be on the floor a lot more than Chicago's does because they don't have the depth behind them. So, you know, does Cleveland wear down a little bit as the series goes on? So, you know, it's a dangerous series for Cleveland, you know, and you know, it's a shame that Love got hurt. It's a shame that J.R. Smith did what he did and is going to miss the first two games because that really hurts them. I think they win it if those two guys are there, but without them, I kind of lean towards what you're saying and just say I don't see how you can favor Cleveland in this series. Doesn't mean they can't win it; just means I don't see how you can favor them.
All right, so here's the question: hey, I'm putting Golden State into the finals. I don't, you know, we talked about Memphis. I don't see Memphis beating them, and I think Golden State will put away either the Clippers or Houston. Do you think anybody that can come out of the East can they give Golden State a series?
They can give them a series. I don't think they can beat them four times. I think they could beat them. I think either Cleveland, I'm not sure right now with the injuries. I think the Bulls could push them to a six or seven game series. I just don't think any of them can score enough and stop Golden State enough to be able to win four games. I mean, that's the real key. You got to beat them four times, and I just don't see that happening.
Yeah, I mean, if Cleveland comes out, you know, I believe that Irving and James are good enough to, despite kind of a lackluster supporting cast, that I think they're good enough to win a game or two, which is hard for me to see them winning more than that. Definitely going to be interested to see what happens with Cleveland and Love. At least the latest report seemed to be that what I'm seeing, it looks like he probably will be back. Are you seeing the same, or do you expect him back?
I haven't seen anything lately. I don't expect him back, personally. I just don't think he likes the way he was utilized. They're not going to make a change at coach. They're not going to all of a sudden do something. Now, the one thing is Cleveland can offer him more money than anybody else. So, you know, ultimately that's going to be tough to turn down. But I personally don't expect him to be back. And, you know, I think that ends up I'm not saying I wouldn't have done the trade, but if he does leave and you don't win and you see what Wiggins is starting to become, that trade starts to look very, very bad for Cleveland. It's totally in hindsight.
It looks horrific
if
you don't sign Love.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's hindsight. You had to get Love back to make that trade because you were giving up the years of control of Wiggins.
Yep.
And maybe you didn't expect Wiggins to immediately be that level of scorer and put it together like he did in the second half, but you're still talking about the number one player in the draft, and or you know whatever he went, I believe it was number one.
Uh-huh.
That you know, he certainly had the upside, and it was years of control. It's a disaster for Cleveland if they don't get Love back.
No doubt. Now they'll be able to get players that'll want to play with LeBron and stuff like that, but still, it's tough. And well, I mean, you think that they will. I mean, they couldn't get players to play with LeBron when he was with Cleveland the first time. So, you know, at least he has Kyrie there and he signed. So it's not a guarantee that they'll be able to do it. But you've also given away assets. You've traded assets to be able to trade for players to make them come there. So, you know, now you're going to have to rely on free agents, and, you know, it's going to be tough. So, Chris, we have a couple minutes left here. Did you want to touch on Suleiman going to Maryland potentially?
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. A little Terps talk to end the show. Maryland, by all accounts, everyone that's already put out a too early look for college basketball for next fall. Maryland in at least the top 10 of everybody, top 5 for some. Some are even talking Jeff Goodman, ESPN, that Maryland could potentially be the preseason number one going into next year. Still looking to fill out their roster a little bit. There is some talk about Suleiman, who was let go from Duke's program last year. Obviously, Rob is a Duke fan. Rob, you can give us a scouting report on Suleiman and if you think that is a player that Maryland really should be pursuing as hard as they apparently are.
Talent on the court, absolutely. This is a guy that after his freshman year, there was talk that he could have left early. He could have been a lower-end lottery pick. I have seen stuff like NBA Draft Net and all talk about him. I remember last year seeing that he could have been a second round pick. I've seen some people think he could be in the first round. So he's a pro. You know, he's probably going to play in the NBA. The problem is his attitude and all off the court. I had no idea the stuff was going on with him, but you know, you would see a lot of sulking when things wouldn't go his way. You would see a lot of attitude, not necessarily towards coaching or anything like that, just not hustling because he misses a layup or something like that. When you see that over the years, you know, that this was more than just a one incident type thing, I tend to think that had a lot to do with it. So what I question is that going to be good for team chemistry on a team that right now could win a national championship without him? Or did this experience and Krzyzewski doing what he did and everything else, did that change him, and is that going to change his attitude? So, I mean, that I don't know. From what I saw at Duke, I don't think I would want to put him on this team with a team that's loaded like this. On the other hand, you could just say, well, we can take a shot with him for a year, and that assumes that he graduates from Duke this year where he is available for this coming year. If he's not for this year and you have him for the following year, then maybe you consider that more because you can get him in the program and everything else, and hopefully you can kind of get him to be the player that you want him to be.
Good thoughts from you there. I'm interested to see if Maryland will get involved with Sterling Gibbs, their former commit who left the program when Gary Williams retired and Turgeon came on. But some Orioles, Ravens, and Terps talk tonight. A little NBA, first show in the books. Always good talk, Rob. Look forward to hearing more about your birthday weekend there. I see Lindsay has sent out an invitation for celebrate the party while we've been on the show. So thanks for hosting. Thanks for listening, everybody. Catch us on the board. Follow us on Facebook, BSL on Twitter at BMore Sports Life. You can follow Rob on Twitter as well at BSL Rob Shields. Any questions or feedback, let us know on the board, and catch us again next week.
Okay. And yeah, just to add to that, yeah, just everybody, thanks for listening, and we should be back next week. Talk to you then.